It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear from a beer writer about the craft beer boom in Wisconsin and if we're reaching a possible saturation point.
First, Republicans and House Speaker Paul Ryan face an uphill battle in Congress as they scramble to get enough votes to pass their plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. Despite intense negotiations, passage of the bill is currently still up in the air and now delayed until at least tomorrow.
A lot is riding on this moment, as Ryan pointed out earlier this week.
This is our chance and this is our moment. It's a big moment, and I think our members are beginning to appreciate just what kind of a rendezvous with destiny we have right here.
Craig Gilbert joins us now. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
So in a recent article out just this morning, you called this vote today on the GOP health care plan an acid test for Paul Ryan. How would you define what's at stake for him?
Well, not just for him, but obviously for his party and for President Trump. But in his case, I mean, he is the speaker. He's less than 2 years into his speakership, but now this is where the rubber really meets the road, because Republicans have unified control of Washington, and it's the first time in 10 years, the first time for a lot of Republicans in Congress that they've actually been accountable and had real power. And they've spent the last several years repealing Obamacare symbolically. Now they have to do it for real and provide a real-life replacement. It's proving to be really tough. He has despite majorities in both chambers, there's no Republican consensus on what the replacement to Obamacare should look like. So he has a massive lift on his hands when it comes to bringing his caucus together on this, on a hugely complicated issue amid kind of this thorny thicket of legislative rules and parliamentary procedures that kind of push the bill in one way in the House to get a House Republican majority, and push the bill in another way in the Senate to get a Senate Republican majority.
And what about the Speaker's relationship with the President, with Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's been striking that so far it's been as good as it has been. It was really important for him to have the president buying in to the bill, even though on paper it doesn't look like it's necessarily something that would have popped out of Trump's head, given the way he campaigned on some of these issues. It's more of a traditional Republican conservative approach. Trump was more of a populist, but Trump has a huge amount at stake. This is the item that tees up the whole Republican agenda in Washington for the next 2 years. And if they stumble out of the box, it's just devastating to not only to the mechanics of legislating going forward, but it's devastating sort of symbolically for what the signal it sends about the ability of Republicans to govern.
Right. You had a quote in your article of an expert saying that maybe the whole GOP agenda would need to be sort of rethought out if this doesn't pass. What is the thinking behind that kind of idea?
Well, there's several pieces to that. One is just the kind of optics and, you know, confidence and solidarity and the implications for all those things. If this fails, I mean, it would just be, you know, the possibility of Republican world just devolving into finger-pointing and acrimony, but also it's just the mechanics of getting things passed. For example, the next big-ticket item after health care is tax reform, which is, again, hugely ambitious on a really difficult issue. But tax reform, they can't really do tax reform the way they want to do tax reform without the tax cuts they're proposing in the Obamacare replacement bill. So if the Obamacare replacement bill dissolves, then that really completely undermines their tax agenda. They've just got huge problems going forward from a mechanical point of view, from a legislative point of view, and from a political point of view.
And here in Ryan's home state, the GOP bill is not polling so well. According to a Marquette University Law School poll that came out just yesterday, 28% of registered voters support Republican replacement of the Affordable Care Act, and 60% support either keeping it as is or improving it. What do those numbers say right now?
That it's not popular. As unpopular as Obamacare seemed to be at times in the last several years, it actually has become more popular with President Obama's departure from office. And now people are focusing on, you know, how to replace it and what the system would look like if you started taking out the benefits and subsidies in Obamacare. And it's kind of frightening to a lot of people. The Republican bill, you know, has winners and losers, and the winners tend to be people higher up the income scale, and the losers tend to be people further down the income scale. And even it has geographic implications. In Wisconsin, if you look at the subsidies and tax credits in the Republican bill that are designed to help people on Obamacare pay for their premiums, the reductions in that kind of assistance would be much steeper in certain parts of Wisconsin than other parts. They would actually be much steeper in northern and western Wisconsin, including areas that voted pretty strongly for Donald Trump, than they would be in parts of southern Wisconsin. So in some cases, the impacts are a little bit perverse sounding, because the kinds of older, rural, blue-collar voters that came in so strongly for Donald Trump, in many cases, those are the kinds of people, if they are enrolled in Obamacare, they would stand to lose the most. And that's, I think that's sobering for some Republican lawmakers, and the national polling reflects that, too. There was a new national poll out today that showed really kind of opposition by large margins to the Republican bill.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert right now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a pending House vote on the Republican replacement to the Affordable Care Act. And as we were talking about earlier, Craig, Republicans hold the majority in Congress right now, but looking specifically at the House especially, it doesn't mean there's consensus in what's happening. Can you talk us through sort of the different factions of Republicans and what they're thinking of, what their attitudes are toward this bill as it stands today?
So one thing that's really emerged in the last few days is the kind of clout of what's called the House Freedom Caucus, which these are this is sort of like the absolute right flank of the Republican House caucus. And even though they're not large in number, we're talking about 30 people, they are mostly no votes right now, and that has given them leverage in a body where Republicans can only afford to lose about 20 or 21 or 22 Republican votes, because no Democrats are voting for this. So it gives a small faction a lot of power. The problem is, as the leadership has been making concessions to its right flank in order to get a bill passed, it endangers support from a larger number of more moderate and mainstream conservatives who are concerned about the kinds of things we've been talking about. They're concerned about, you know, the impact on premiums, the impact on subsidies, and so now that they're talking about, for example, possibly dismantling some of the mandates in Obamacare in terms of what insurance plans have to offer, some of the more popular aspects of Obamacare, it really kind of endangers the Republican bill from an entirely different direction. And finally, I would just say on top of that, the map is different in the Senate than it is in the House. And so as this bill moves to the right in the House, it becomes a bigger lift in the Senate, where there are more Republican moderates and where they can actually afford even fewer defections. Since there are only 52 Republican senators, that means if you lose three of them, the bill is dead.
And again, this vote is looking likely to come down later today. As it stands, as far as we know, are the votes there for Paul Ryan?
They are not there right now. Now, you know, it's going to depend on how successful President Trump is in persuading enough members of this right-wing faction in the House Republican caucus to come on board, and then what price is paid to bring them on board and the reaction to that among more moderate members. And layering on top of all that are some really complicated parliamentary issues affecting, you know, what kinds of provisions in the bill require 50 votes in the Senate and what kinds require 60 votes in the Senate. So the House could end up succeeding in the end in passing a bill that still may be a political non-starter in the Senate, would have to be changed for political reasons, but they could also end up passing a bill that would run into parliamentary trouble in the Senate because the original purpose of crafting the House bill the way it was to avoid having to meet the 60-vote threshold that we think of because of the filibuster rule in the Senate. A bill has to be designed in certain ways to do that, and that may all be out the window as this bill undergoes some changes. So it's a lot of chaos, a lot of complexity.
It's going to be an interesting day. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
That was Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the delayed vote to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act and why a lot is riding on it for Republicans.
Beer making has enjoyed a long and storied history in Wisconsin, and the boom of craft breweries over the past few decades doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon.
But with so many craft breweries popping up in Wisconsin, will we see craft beer production outpace the demand? And are we inching toward peak craft beer? Robin Shepherd joins us now. He's a regional beer writer, senior contributor to the Isthmus, and associate professor of life sciences communications at UW Extension. Robin, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
Well, Robin, give us a status check. Where is Wisconsin right now when it comes to the number of craft breweries?
Well, anyone who's walked in a grocery store or a beer store lately certainly sees the impact and the interest in craft beer. It's amazing what our choices are in front of us. When you just think about what's happening in the craft brewing industry overall, we're at a pace right now that we're opening two breweries every day in the United States. That's an amazing figure when you think about the sheer number of breweries and per capita, how that relates to the citizens of the country. We're still on sort of a juggernaut in terms of growth in the craft brewing industry. And Wisconsin is, too, perhaps not quite at the pace that we're seeing things in other states, but Wisconsin's industry is growing quite rapidly, too.
And this question has come up on and off over the last few years, and we've seen some national articles raising the question, all right, so now are we hitting a point where there are too many, where there's not enough demand for this product to keep up with all these new craft breweries opening? Where do you see us, Robin, on the supply versus demand?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that really, I've been covering beer for probably 20, 25 years, and it's one that question has, you're exactly right, it's come up more and more, particularly in the last 5 years. There was probably something maybe magical in our minds that when we crossed the threshold of 2,500 breweries in the United States, everybody started talking about, is there a bubble out there? When's this going to crash? We crossed the 2,500 brewery list, several years ago, and now we just crossed 5,000 breweries. And that growth is continuing. So from my perspective, I don't see that there's a bubble that's about to burst. We are seeing signs that there are some slowdowns in terms of production. If you just look at the numbers and the growth, we crossed 5,000 breweries in 2016. The year before, nationally, we had 4,200 breweries. So that's where, you're rapidly accelerating the sheer openings. In the production of beer, when you look at sales across the United States, up until 2016, we've been seeing some really tremendous growth in just the overall demand for craft beer and the sales of it. Individual breweries were looking at their individual growth rates of 20 to 40%. Even in Wisconsin, some breweries were reporting 40% growth in their barrelage from 2013 to 2014. What's happening now is there's a tightening in the market, in part caused by more breweries and more beers on the shelf, and there's only so much shelf space when you really think about it. we've seen some of those numbers that have been that overall increase in brewery production that's been sort of slowed down to maybe into double digits, but more in the 10 to 20% range. In Wisconsin, when I've talked to a few brewers, we've seen those slowdowns, not across the board. I mean, it all depends upon what brewery you're talking about. But I've heard stories from some breweries that said, you know, I'm producing 10% less this year than I did before. That's not threatening my business, but it's certainly forcing me to rethink when I brew, how much I brew, what styles I'm brewing. So that slowdown is kind of, we're seeing it in different ways.
Robin, who is drinking all this craft beer? Are there new craft beer drinkers who didn't drink maybe any beer before? Or are people just switching up what it is they're drinking?
Well, you can look at when we talk about the increases in craft, the first level of that discussion is you look at overall beer consumption in the United States is going down, whether it's health-related, whether it's the tightening of driving under the influence laws. Beer consumption continues to go down overall, but the segment of the craft brewing industry continues to grow. Right now, craft controls about 13 to 15% of the market, of the overall beer that's sold in the United States. Now, the second part of your question is, who's drinking the beer? In a general way, when we think about sort of, you know, the millennials versus the Gen Xers versus the boomers, in a study by the Brewers Association, they came up with numbers that of the people who drink craft beer, 57% of the millennials right now in that age group are gravitating and drinking craft beer. Of the boomers, well, we'll step back. Millennials, it's 57%. Gen Xers, it's 24%. Boomers are 17%. So you can see that as people are kind of going through their life, they're getting maybe perhaps more conscious about health issues, alcohol consumption. They begin to taper down. But the millennials, when you go out to have a beer with friends, if you go out to a tap house somewhere, you know, for someone in my generation that's in one of those other brackets, you're beginning to see that young crowd, that excitement over local, that excitement over finding beers, that's driving it a lot. There are other trends like beer tourism that are just exploding right now.
Talking to Robin Shepherd, he's a regional beer writer, looking at the ongoing boom in craft breweries, lots of them, over 5,000 now in the nation as a whole, and whether we're getting close to some kind of peak. Robin, can you tell us about the diversity of sizes of craft brewery? As I understand it, that could mean something very small or a fairly large-scale operation.
Yeah, that's another thing that's been fun to watch in the last maybe 10 or 15 years. When we throw this term out about craft brewing, in some ways that's a little bit of a marketing tag that small breweries have put on themselves to distinguish them from the big guys. The Brewers Association, which is really a guiding force in the industry, will define a craft brewer as someone that's small, producing less than 6 million barrels a year. So that can be everything from the Partstiegel Brew Pub in Madison that's brewing on a one-barrel system all the way up to Sam Adams. Those fall into what's craft. And the characteristics that go with a small brewery are usually very independent. They take pride in not being affiliated with ownership of a non-brewery entity. They have distinctive individualistic approaches to customers. They tend to be involved in communities. That local-driven aspect of them is very important and continues to grow. And they also are more of a traditional aspect on their brewing. They still brew with traditional ingredients. The Brewers Association kind of cuts you off if a significant part of your products involve infused or beverages that are made with non-malt kinds of ingredients. But that's basically, when you think of a craft brewery, it's the small, independent kind of operation.
And Robin, you said before there was a little bit of a slowdown and that some brewers being a little more thoughtful about the styles that they're producing. What do we know about what styles are the most in demand right now?
Well, in brewing circles and with beer folks, there's probably around 100 different styles. I'm just kind of rounding, but when you think about judge styles that are accepted, that brewers like to compare and compete against each other, you're about 100. And what we're seeing in this proliferation of new breweries coming online is that we're seeing a sort of a bending and emerging of styles. Sort of sub-styles are beginning to appear, different ways of making some styles. Right now, of craft beer drinkers, the most sought-after style, the most popular style, is just about anything hoppy. The India Pale Ale is the number one style right now among craft beer drinkers. Now, that's much different if you were to go back into the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. You know, the entire brewing industry revolved around competition for the premium Pilsner style of beer. And so it's much, much different. Now we've got all of these styles. When you walk into a brew pub or a craft production brewery of some kind, it's not uncommon that you might see a tower with anywhere from 8 to 24 tap lines, and that would reflect the different styles or mutations of those styles.
Robin, I got to ask, you're a beer writer. There's over 5,000 of these breweries, each making, as you said, 8 to 24, maybe different beers and 100 different styles. How do you keep up?
Well, the fact of the matter is that you really don't. When I wrote my first book, interestingly enough, in the 1990s, I took great pride that I went to all 73 Wisconsin breweries. That was in the late 1990s. I went not only once, but I went three times before I wrote that book. There's no way you can do that now. Wisconsin alone has somewhere around 140 breweries, and it's a little more elusive now, where we saw production breweries emerge in the 1990s and brew pubs. Now we have this really fascinating model called the nano brewery, which might be a glorified homebrew system in the back of a tavern or a restaurant somewhere that's producing beers at one barrel at a time, very eclectic. Some really fun stuff happens. The ability to almost pair beer and food on a daily basis sometimes exists with those wonderful little small operations. It's also, for me, as I've gotten into this even further, is part of the fun thing for me is the challenge of finding them, hearing the story on the other side of the bar about how they came to be. This idea of local is bringing them back in force. The local market is so important to those small brewers that they, you know, wrap themselves around the community. Everything from knowing the specific guy that's or gal that's drinking on the other side of the bar to being philanthropic to the community.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Robin Shepherd, regional beer writer, looking at the booming craft beer industry in Wisconsin. Since 2011, voucher programs have been expanded by the state legislature in Wisconsin. Milwaukee's decades-old voucher program was replicated in Racine, and then Governor Walker signed into law a statewide expansion of voucher schools and a special needs voucher program.
This year, the number of private schools accepting vouchers is expanding, and each year, the cap on the allowable percentage of voucher students in a district goes up. The numbers are drawing out tensions between public schools and private voucher schools.
Advocates of voucher schools say competition benefits students and families, while critics worry that the funding going to those voucher schools will ultimately hurt the quality of education at public schools.
Erin Richards joins us now. She's the education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
Well, Erin, why is this coming school year, next fall, shaping up to be maybe a pivotal one when it comes to these tensions that you wrote about in communities and in schools over the state's voucher program?
Statewide voucher program started in the fall of 2014. That was the first year that it went live, and it was really tightly capped in the first couple of years. I think only about 500 kids could participate in the first year. Only 1,000 children, I think, were limited in the second year, and then we started going toward this cap. So it started with 1%. This year we're going toward 2% of the kids who live in a district are eligible. No more than that can attend a private school in that area on a voucher. And the next year it'll be 3% and 4% the following year, up until 10%, and then an unlimited number of kids can participate. The reason why we took a closer look at this program this year is that there's enough traction with this program now that more private schools around the state are sort of like, you know what, this might make sense for us. You know, maybe our enrollment's dropping. Maybe we could bolster what we're doing with some additional funding. So this was the year it just felt like more schools were kind of jumping in. And when we saw the numbers this winter of the number of private schools that had signed up to participate in the program for the first time, we saw way more schools statewide that jumped in as opposed to Racine, which is geographically limited, and Milwaukee, which has been around for so long that there's a, kind of a saturation point that's happened here with private schools that register. So the growth that we're seeing in the moment is really in the statewide, you know, private schools statewide, and that's why it felt like a good time to take a look at what was happening.
Now, you've been on this show before explaining the differences between public schools and charter schools and voucher schools, and I think it bears doing a quick check-in on that because sometimes the terminology is confusing. Erin, what is a voucher school versus, let's say, a charter school?
Sure. Voucher schools are always private schools. Most of them are religious schools. And the whole point of a voucher is to offer a taxpayer-funded tuition subsidy for a child to attend a private, usually religious school. That's very different from charter schools because charter schools are fully public. They just operate with some more flexibility from the traditional rules that a public school would follow. So, again, the big difference is charter schools are public. They operate kind of like your normal public school, but they've got some freedom from rules. They might be able to have a longer school day. They might be able to mandate uniforms. Voucher schools are always private, so they are wholly private institutions, and they don't necessarily have to turn over data like high school graduation rates or staff rosters. So they're just, they operate as private entities, but they receive taxpayer funding to give parents more options on where to send their kids to school.
And so essentially what happens if a student is going to a public school, that school gets a certain amount of money to finance that student's education, they leave for a private voucher school, what happens to the money?
Sure. So a couple things happen. And in the statewide program, you have to be kind of specific about what's happening. If you are attending a public school and you're eligible to switch over and take a voucher to a local private school, it actually benefits the district or the taxpayers, I should say, because the cost of the voucher is less than the cost that we pay for students in public schools, taxpayers would actually see a little bit of a decrease because all of a sudden that student who was in a public school would suddenly be in the private school on less taxpayer money overall. But in the first couple years of the statewide program, we didn't see that happening. What we saw, because of the way the legislation was written, was that it allowed kids who were already in the private schools and were already attending as private pay students, or maybe they were on a scholarship that was offered by the church or the school itself, those kids could just switch over if they met the income requirement, which is pretty low. I think you have to come from a family that's making no more than about $44,000 if you're a family of four. But if you were in the private school and you met that income requirement, you could flip over and use a voucher. And that worried school districts statewide in the beginning because they saw that all of a sudden, starting last year, they had to raise additional taxes for kids who were already in the private schools. They had flipped over to using a voucher in the first couple of years of the program. And so then they were raising money for kids who weren't part of their district to begin with. They were private school students. And that's where you saw the real concern. And because this is such a new program and districts outstate haven't really dealt with these complexities in the way that Milwaukee schools have for a long time, that's where you saw some of the worry come in because districts were saying, hey, look, we're raising taxes on our residents for some kids, and it may not be a ton yet. It might be 5, might be 10, might be 20. But we're raising taxes for kids that we've never had to fund before. So that's actually having an impact on our local property taxpayers. They're paying a little bit more to pay for these students if they were never part of our public system.
And Erin, you wrote about the Chilton School District, a place that seemed like a model for community cohesion, but you saw that it may be that there is some of this tension you're writing about over voucher schools that could strain that community. Can you tell us about that situation?
Sure. So Chilton is like some small towns in Wisconsin that just have one public elementary school, a public middle school, a public high school, and then there's one other school option in town, a private school option, that's Chilton Area Catholic School. Now, for a long time, Chilton Area Catholic School and the public school system have had a really good relationship. In small towns especially, everybody knows each other. You see these people at the grocery stores. The Catholic school would use the high school auditorium for events. When the high school was building its new performing arts center, students from the Chilton Public School used the Catholic school facilities. So all of those relationships, in many ways, have been sort of your traditional relationship in small towns between public and private entities. But now that there's the program that introduces a funding component here, and in some ways, when you're introducing competition to the school marketplace, you do set up schools to look at the fact that if you are having to raise money to pay for students in another system, you are introducing some concern, at least in Chilton, and the superintendent is fairly new there. And she said, look, you know, I have nothing against the principal at the Catholic school. We've had a good relationship in the 6 months that I've been here. But, you know, I worry about what this means for my district in the long run. And in many ways, I would not say in Wisconsin that there are all-out fights in these communities. In a lot of places, people are adjusting to the new reality. You know, in all the ways you normally would. But in some places, the tension is a little bit under the surface. Nobody really wants to speak bad about their neighbor. But a lot of superintendents feel that, you know, they need to advocate for their district, but they might be refraining from putting stuff on their Facebook district page that says, hey, you know, like, don't use vouchers because then they receive some negative comments from folks in the community who are in favor of private school vouchers. So it's introducing a new component, and people are, for the most part, learning to navigate it. And I think some communities are navigating the new reality easier than others.
You did hear some concern about the way that the tax money is raised for these vouchers, in that it is not, it doesn't seem to be necessarily transparent on the form where the money is going to. Can you explain that a little more?
Sure. So again, this would be for students who, for districts that are raising money for students who were never part of their public system. So in reality, this means that there's a certain number of kids in private schools that flip to using a voucher in the first couple years of the program. And the districts that those children are in are on the hook for paying for those kids for the rest of their education career, as long as they stay on a voucher in the private school, in ways that that district was never obligated to pay for those kids before. So if you started your private school career, you stayed in private schools all the way through, the public school district, I mean, you as your family, if you own property, you would be paying property taxes toward the public school district, but you wouldn't be utilizing that option, and the public school wouldn't really be paying for you because you're outside of their realm. So in districts where the students flip to using a voucher and that are in the private school, the district is having to raise tax dollars for those students, but it flows right through them and to the private school. So in some districts around the state, I heard superintendents say, you know, we just wish this was more transparent. We wish that people knew that this part of the levy is actually for your public schools. And this additional part of the levy that we had to raise is actually for these 5 or 10 or 20 kids that are attending the private school in town. And a lot of superintendents just wanted that to be more transparent because they felt that if people knew the financial breakdown, it might change their opinions, or at least it might just let them know this is what you're paying for and this is how the new program works.
Erin Richards stays with us now. She's the education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're talking about her recent piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about growing tensions between public school districts and the growing number of voucher schools in Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. As the statewide voucher program expands, available everywhere, what's happening in your community? Do you see this tension between public and voucher schools? How are things working out if you're a parent, if you work in a public or private school that's taking vouchers? How do you see this playing out in your district? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Erin Richards is with us. She's the education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about what may be growing tensions between public school districts and voucher schools in Wisconsin as the number of voucher schools goes up.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's happening in your community? Are you seeing this tension between the public schools and private schools now that vouchers are available in more places, everywhere, more or less? Do you support Wisconsin's growing move toward supporting private schools via vouchers? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Jacob on the line with us first in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hi. To me, it seems a bit like there's some tortured reasoning in presenting this issue to the public. I just want to bring up the point that aren't these school properties also tax-free as religious organizations?
So, Erin, are some of these private schools receiving some tax relief already?
You know, I'm not quite sure how that would play into the funding scheme, but as you know, as the schools that are part of churches, you know, parish schools, so quite a few Catholic and Lutheran schools around the state that are now participating in this program, they certainly are, you know, afforded the tax-free option as being part of a religious institution. So that is one element, but I think the new twist or the new element that makes this sort of a new dynamic statewide is the transfer of public funds and public dollars to those institutions that weren't getting them before.
Jacob, thanks for the call and the question. We go on to Liz joining us in Eau Claire. Hi, Liz.
Hi there. My question is, it's sort of, I have, in Eau Claire, the children who signed up for the voucher, according to our local newspaper, a lot of them were already enrolled in the private religious school. And so it seems to me that these parents who receive vouchers for their children to attend a school they're already attending, when I thought the intent of the program was to help lower-income children attend a school of their choice. It just doesn't seem like it's working that way, in Eau Claire anyway.
Liz, thanks for the question. Aaron, what do you say to that?
Yeah, Liz, this is a really great question, and a lot of people have asked that very same question. Actually, after the first 2 years of the program, Republicans who are in charge of the government right now realized that this was happening, that the intent wasn't just to fund students switching from being a private pay student onto a voucher. If the intent was to allow students an option, to allow especially public school students who maybe could never consider private school because they couldn't afford it. So if that was the intent, then they needed to figure out ways to make sure that they weren't encouraging just the flipping. And that is actually in place now. It sort of quietly went into effect last year. I think there'll be some more publicity about it this year. They've limited now how and which students can get vouchers. So they've limited it to children who are entering school for the first time in kindergarten, or so kindergarten, 3-year-old kindergarten, 4-year-old kindergarten, or first grade. Whether you're a public or a private school student, you can enter at the first grade level or the 9th grade level. So they've tried to limit it to those transitional points, meaning that if you just happen to be a 3rd grade student in a private school right now that has decided to accept vouchers, in the first 2 years of the program, if you met the income requirement, you could have just flipped. Now you actually have to wait until you're up to that 9th grade level, then you could switch to using a voucher.
Liz, thanks so much for that question. And we're going to move to Jerry in Eureka next. Jerry, hi.
Hi. My question is related to the statement that was made that private schools are doing the educational process at a less cost than the public school. How do you factor in the cost of special needs children, that whether the child who typically attends the public school is in the public school and maybe a $1,000 a year child, or the speech language therapist, or the Title I into the private school, how do you factor that into your cost analysis?
Jerry, thanks for that. Aaron?
Yep. So this is another really good question, because most people who work in education or just know anything about education know that to educate students with mild to severe special needs costs more money. They need more specialists. They need more individualized instruction. They, you know, the needs of every child are quite different when they have disabilities, especially. So those costs can go up. And what happens is, if a child with a special need decides to switch into a private school on a voucher, that school, the private school, doesn't get more money for that child. However, there is another program that was started recently in Wisconsin. It's called the Special Needs Voucher Program. It is still a voucher program, but it is limited to a certain number of children in the state. And if children qualify for that voucher and they switch to a private school, they bring their private school up to, I think, about $12,000. At least that's what it was in the first year. It might be going up a little bit this year. But that's the only other way that a private school would get those additional monies to help serve a child with special needs, is if they were receiving a child who qualified for that special needs voucher. Otherwise, it's up to the parent. If they think that the private school can still serve their children in the way that they think they, you know, need services on the cost of the voucher alone, or however else a private school decides to subsidize that, that is up to the parent and their choice.
Jerry, thank you for the question. And Aaron, one school official you spoke to said that they were worried about a gulf springing up between what they called elite students who went to private schools and the students who went to public schools. Do we have data about who's going to which school and how that could be affecting, for example, reporting of grades and that kind of thing under the growing voucher system so far?
The data is really difficult to track on this, because what you'll find, especially in private schools across the state, is they don't classify children as special needs in the same way that public schools do. The reason why public schools know very specifically how many students with special needs they're serving is that under the IDEA, that's a federal law that mandates public schools must serve students with special needs, school districts develop an individual plan for each of those students. So it's very easy to track what percentage of a district is part of the special needs population. Private schools don't necessarily track those numbers. They're not under obligation of the federal law to serve those students in the same way. And parents may not want their children labeled in the private school. So overall, what that means is, when you hear that concern from the public school, is that there is this lingering fear that parents who are the most advantaged and the most able to make decisions for their children may try to switch them into schools that they perceive as being, you know, smaller class sizes, or if they're private, maybe they've got additional resources for kids, and that it would leave sort of the higher needs, the more expensive to serve students, the most difficult to serve students, the bigger behavior problem students, that those students would be sort of left in the public school. And in some ways, that means that the cost of the really expensive students, the ones with, expensive to serve special needs, gets spread out over a smaller number of students. So over time, it could become, theoretically, if you play this out, it could become more difficult for a district to serve those students if more of their sort of higher performing, elite students, if you will, leave the district.
And Aaron, both President Trump and his education secretary are supporters of voucher schools. We've seen a little money pledged that way so far. Is that likely to change, maybe dramatically change, the landscape even more here in Wisconsin?
Well, there was initially this idea floated that, President Trump, during his campaign, promised, $20 billion for school choice. That means charter school options and voucher school options. The likelihood of a federal voucher program is just very unlikely. What would be more likely is some kind of maybe a first-ever federal tuition tax credit, or something that would sort of indirectly benefit private schools. A lot of states still have laws on the books that actually prohibit the flow of public funding into religious institutions. Wisconsin doesn't have that, but I think more than 30 other states still do. So at the federal level, that other option could be one way to get around that. What we know is that there's an appetite for it. President Trump, Betsy DeVos, Vice President Michael Pence, who presided over a rapid expansion of private school choice in Indiana, are all in favor of these types of publicly funded options that may be outside of your traditional school district. So I think you're going to see more activity around that, but we just don't know exactly what it's going to look like yet, and we don't know what it'll be, how it will affect states at the local level. I still think more of the activity is going to be driven by state houses, but there certainly is an appetite for it and an invitation to consider it from the federal administration.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Aaron Richards, education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she was with us there to talk about growing tensions in some communities between public school districts and voucher schools, which are on the rise here in Wisconsin. And if this is something you're seeing play out in your community, in your family, let us know what you think. Share your stories, your questions over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Thank you.
We've all been there. It's past dinner time, well past bedtime, not too far off, but we want a snack. We know we shouldn't, and yet. So then the question is, what's like a healthy-ish nighttime snack?
Well, we came across some nutrition advice in a New York Times column today that tackles that question. The best answer, sadly, is probably no snack at all. But that said, you know, the better snacks are healthy things, things that you didn't eat enough of maybe during the day. That leaves you with your fruits and veggies, your low-fat dairy, cottage cheese, I think, was one of the things they floated, whole grains and nuts, fish and beans. Although, who's going to have fish and beans for a before-bed snack?
Yeah, I mean, the whole list really is not the kind of things that I have the urge to snack on at that point in the day. And, you know, I'm a different person. Here you see my sweet tooth. Nighttime, I want the salty, crunchy snacks, chips. If I have, flavored pretzels lying around, I'm going to go to them. That kind of thing. Very the worst possible things I think I could eat at night. What's your nighttime snack of
choice? It's always going to be cheese. Cheese, and cheese. Yeah, cheese and crackers, and that is actually one of the things. But I think they suggest something like a single piece of cheese on a single cracker, and that just seems ridiculous. It's nighttime. Cheese and crackers.
I know, maybe we could recalibrate our expectations to where that one little taste of the crackers and cheese does, because you're not really hungry then, right?
So you're going to eat one potato chip?
No.
that's
not
going to
happen.
You're listening to Central Time.